So Father's Day, that's where we are today. It's a beautiful Sunday. It's a beautiful privilege to be a father. And for me as a father, father of three, when I think of Father's Day, this is the word that comes to mind. Unavoidably, is the concept of succession. Is the concept that you and I, we are the result of men and women, but specifically on Father's Day, I believe fathers, what they do, they create a wake. They create a path. They unavoidably put together some sort of a transition that, whether we like it or not, we process, we bring out a baton and bring it into the next generation. So succession for me is a major, major component. Part of it is because I still consider myself, although I may not look like one, I still consider myself a middle-aged guy. Okay, I'm 46 this year, and the implication of my middle age transition, you know, life is that I'm seeing the results more tangibly of the succession of those that went before me, dad in my case, and because what I do in the calling into pastoral ministry, I look at the pastors and how they have shaped me and trained me and equipped me and discipled me. So this becomes a tangible reality. Then I turn around and I look at my 21-year-old daughter, my 19-year-old daughter, my almost 17-year-old son, and as they continue to make decisions as now young adults, more and more independently from us as parents, now I see either the positive or the not-so-positive influence of our succession into their lives, because now they're making their own decisions. So this morning, what I want you to think about for a second is the concept of succession, because for us, we have been navigating this concept of world mandate, the concept of missions, and specifically the subtitle says discipling, not just evangelism, but discipleship, which is evangelism and discipleship. I should have said this at the beginning of the series. I forgot, but I'll tell you right now. Evangelism and discipleship is like the two sides of a coin. Which of the two is more important? The answer is yes, right? The coin is made of two sides. So it's exactly the same thing with evangelism and discipleship. So it's not just coming to know Christ, it's to have the worldview of Christ. That's what it implies. So for me, again, just thinking about the concept of succession, the character, the book in the Bible, so if you have a Bible, you want to go there, is exactly this amazing, amazing guy by the name of Daniel. And ironically, and I say ironically, it's kind of intentional or non-intentional because it's just the way this unfolds today. I'm going to be speaking to you about a guy and guys, two more in just a second, two more biblical characters. And all three, for what we understand and know, they were single guys. What am I implying? That on Father's Day, by default, we speak of guys who are either married, have been married. Maybe we speak of single dads as well, so may not be married currently. But the reality that I'm giving you is that when we look at this process of succession, Daniel, as a single man, we believe he was single, or at least we understand he was single, is that component that in his life as a single man, we try to convey this message that the win is not singleness nor marriage. I'm going to even say this. The win is not to be a father. For us, the win is to see how this individual and individuals, we're going to talk about more guys in just a second, in their singleness, in their married life, in their personal life, in their public life, they were able to navigate a world that was post-Christian. Because I think this is where we are. So again, think in the concept of succession, because we're part of a generation that we have seen a lot of changes lately, haven't we? You guys remember how things used to be in the past? And I'll just give you a quick example. So yesterday, I was privileged. My son and I have one son, two daughters. My son and I, we were able to have lunch with my dad. My dad is in his 71, 72, somewhere around there. I keep on forgetting his age. But we got to see him and took him to lunch. And I remember him telling me a couple of weeks ago that he was going to go home, which for us, hometown, it's about 6 hours into the interior of Mexico. And he said, I'm going to go and because your uncles, my dad is one of 14, you know, brothers and sisters, 7 and 7. And he says, you know, the boys want to get together, his brothers. And I said, well, that's pretty neat. And that was weeks ago. When I saw him yesterday, he told me, hey, we made the trip and we got together as boys. And I said, wow, okay, so I want to hear talk to me. So he starts telling me, now my son is present, but my dad is telling me. Now, again, my dad is somewhere in the middle between the 14 brothers and sisters. He's somewhere in the middle. And so the conversation among the boys, and somewhere between the oldest is getting closer to the 80-year-old mark, and then the youngest is somewhere in the late 50s. So they actually gathered together at my grandmother's home house, which is empty today because both of them, the parents are gone. My grandparents are long gone. So they gathered together, and I'm listening to the conversation, and unavoidably, I'm sitting there. Now, watch, I mean, again, you're looking at my son, which is almost 17, born in the beautiful state of Texas, primarily English speaker, with a father of mine who speaks no English, and came to the States when he was about my age. So you're looking at two different ways of seeing life. Anybody tracking what I'm saying? So the conversation with my dad is filtered through the worldview of having his brothers where they grew up as now 80, almost 80-year-olds, 70-year-olds, 60-year-olds, just having fun and enjoying themselves. What I'm trying to tell you is this, is that when I look at Daniel, if you look at the context of Daniel as a man, Daniel comes into the picture in the narrative of the Bible in a time where because of oppression, because of the fall of Jerusalem, the Babylonians come and conquered, he is taken captive with a bunch of other people into Babylon. So from one day to another, Daniel is taken from his country, his worldview, his environment, and he's put into a very different environment. So in my mind, again, just trying to make the analogy, I'm thinking of my 16-year-old son. If I were going to take him from right here from where he's at and then put him into the conversation, in the middle of the conversation that my daddy was having with his brothers, he will be lost. My son will be lost. First is the language. That might be a little bit of a barrier. And the other one is just the environment, the context. So what I'm trying to tell you is Daniel is placed into a context that is completely anti-God of the Scriptures. The question is, how do you live in that context? Because I believe that's where we are today. So here's what the principles that I want you to navigate with me, that I believe this is how Daniel did it. And as a father, I'm praying, I'm seeking the face of God as I look into my sons, into I see the legacy of my parents brought into my life and seeing the gospel continue. What Daniel did is he was faithful. He was faithful. And the faithfulness of Daniel was to basically monotheism. Now, the concept of monotheism in the Old Testament is very unique. It's basically mono, one, God. So the Bible introduces the concept of one single God. Deuteronomy chapter 6, verse 9, and verses 4 and following is basically Moses, prior to conquering the land, says, O Israel, remember this, that the Lord your God is one. It's one God. It's one God. So Daniel remains faithful as a worshiper of one single God. He does it, this is what it means. So this is the concept, this is the non-tangible, this is the abstract idea, this is the personal conviction reflected into a lifestyle. He does it respectfully in the context of monarchy, authoritarianism, the concept of having a king who does not worship the God of the Scripture. So translate that into your kids, my kids, our grandkids, and our great-grandkids eventually. How do they remain faithful to the God of the Bible in a governmental system that is rapidly and gradually and unapologetically moving away from the values of the Scriptures? How do you do that? Aren't you glad you came? That's what we're, to me, that's exactly what I say is succession. Because succession is more than, oh, he just looks like me. You know, we have the same genes and we speak the same language and we have from the same background. No, this is the concept of look at the unresolved tension. And then here's the beauty of this. And this is the freedom of the gospel. The freedom of the gospel is that when you remain faithful. So again, I wish I had more time to explain this in detail. I'm not speaking of you having faith in God. Having faith in God is never the goal. Having faith in God is always the beginning. The goal is that your faith crystallizes into faithfulness. There are multiple Bibles, multiple books in the Bible that they're written because those who actually or apparently believe in God or had faith in God eventually became unfaithful to God. If I can just come back to Daniel, the tragedy of Daniel's scenario, captivity, you know, a tragedy into the people of God, is because of their unfaithfulness to God. Does that make sense? So translate that into now, look at the combination of both. So faithful to the God of the Scriptures, respectful to the authorities that God has placed and created. All right, do I need to explain that? Okay, again, I'm translating Father's Day into the concept of discipling the next generation to make and to do decisions through a Christian worldview, in a non-Christian world. So when I talk to you about respectfully into a context opposite to the God of the Scriptures, which is authoritarian, which is a concept of a monarchy, not just a monarchy, but a monarchy completely detached from God, what I'm trying to tell you is that the more that we learn to trust in the trustworthiness of Jesus, the more that we are able not to change our government, not to change our surroundings. Because you may know this story, you may not know this story, but Daniel doesn't have that beautiful happy ending that eventually he changes Babylon. Daniel is going to have to do his entire life in ministry and faithfulness in a context of a broken system. So I am not here to promise you that United States of America is going to go back to faithfulness to God. I'm here to tell you, without sounding too critical and negative, is that United States of America is going to eventually look like Canada. Sorry, Canadians, if you're here. In a sense of secularism. And Canada is eventually going to look like Europe when it comes to secularism. Is anybody following what I'm saying? So that's exactly where this is going. It's in the Scripture. It's expected. I mean, all that I'm trying to tell you is when you embrace the worldview of the Bible, watch this, please, you recognize that every authority on the face of the earth in human history is limited. None of them is supreme. And that includes and begins with us as fathers. So as much as I am called to lead, to oversee, to shepherd, to protect, to nurture the home, my position and my function of leadership is always in the context of a supreme leadership and authority. The question is, how do you navigate a home as a 20-year-old guy, as a 17-year-old young lady, talking about our kids and our grandkids, where the home is not the most conducive, where maybe our kids or our grandkids are going through, you know, a difficult scenario in their marriage, or maybe work, or maybe vocation. What look at me. What if our kids and our grandkids are going through a phase in life where they are struggling with their own identity, emotionally, sexually, even spiritually, and they're walking away from the faith? How do you do that? How do you make those decisions? Well, ultimately, here's the thing, is that Daniel is going to make all these transitions of succession in a very godly, honoring manner by simply contextualizing both of these things in a polytheistic culture, which is the opposite of monotheism. Mono means one, poly means many. So Daniel, from one day to another, he's brought into the culture, and we're going to look into that for the next of the summer, so come back and you can see the rest of the movie. You're going to see that he's going to, the first thing that he's going to be, chapter one, he's going to be imposed, he's going to be brought into a specific diet, things that he's supposed to eat, based on what? On polytheism, because obviously life, be from intellectual, relational, emotional, spiritual, everything is interconnected. So this is where I want to see that as the win. Ultimately, and this is what I told you last week, if you were here, if you were not here last week, you can go online and watch, you know, the rest of the stuff. Have you downloaded the app, our church app? Just that you can get all that in our church app. So anyways, you can do that. But here is how I know. Last week, I introduced to you the heart. This is the heart of the book of Daniel, which, by the way, Daniel is what is called apocalyptic literature. It's a piece of literature, ancient literature, divine-inspired literature, that has to do with the concept of end times, with the concept of apocalyptic, with the concept of how things are supposed to look into the future. So he gave us, this is the heart of Daniel. The heart of Daniel begins from chapter 7, verse 13, where Daniel, based on the three things that I just gave you, he comes into this revelation, into this vision as a seer, that at night he looked, and there before me, without me asking, without me actually, you know, meditating, simply showed up before me the one like a son of man. What's the point? That Daniel is having the vision of the pre-incarnate Jesus. Daniel is not saying, listen to me for a second. Daniel is not saying, this is what you and I would have loved to hear Daniel said if we were Jewish people in the middle of captivity. We would have loved for Daniel to say, in my vision, at night, I looked, and there before me was the nation of Israel getting free from the Babylonians. No, that's not what he's saying. Daniel is saying, in the middle of captivity, what I saw was not necessarily the one that is going to free you from the Babylonians, although he can, but it's the one that is the reason, the purpose, the actual reality why you exist. And his name is the Son of Man. Look at what he did. The Son of Man coming with the clouds of heaven, with the glory and the majesty of God. And it is the Son of Man, not Israel. It is the Son of Man, not me, Daniel saying. It is the Son of Man, not the Babylonians, that actually approach the Ancient of Days. Approaching God implies that he was led into the presence of God. So again, we're going to detail this conversation more in the weeks to come. But remember that the presence of God for this audience, for Daniel and the audience, had to do with the temple that Solomon built and the Babylonians destroyed. Meaning, for the Babylonian, for the Jewish in this time in history, the presence of God is long gone because the temple is gone. Because now there is a new sheriff in town. There is someone that rules now over them. And Daniel is saying, yeah, I know you lost the temple. I know you are going through physical, emotional, relational scenario. My authority, my supremacy hasn't changed in spite of what's going on in your life. So here's what it means. It means that this Son of Man, Jesus, was given. What did he receive? Not Nebuchadnezzar, not the Babylonians, not the Israelites, not the Jewish community, but Jesus received authority, Jesus receives glory, Jesus receives sovereign power, which again, if I'm part of the audience, if I'm part of the synagogue, if I'm part of the people reading this ancient writings, I'm like, this is completely nonsense, because if anybody has authority, if anybody has glory, if anybody has sovereign power, it's Nebuchadnezzar, right? He's the guy in charge, and Daniel is saying, mm-mm. Now, I know the thing looks like everything is lost. In God and through God, nothing is lost. God has the ability to utilize your brokenness and even your sinfulness. Listen to me closely. God has the ability to utilize what you are, who you are, where you've been, or where you're heading to. He has the ability to utilize those things without approving them. So do not mix those two principles, because I hear some people say, I really believe God is calling me to divorce my wife. Nonsense. Does that make sense? Don't hear me say that God finds pleasure in tragedy, in brokenness, and sinfulness. That is not what I'm saying. All that I'm saying is that human freedom and ability to lean towards sin has never been a limitation on the authority, the glory, and the power of Jesus Christ. That's all that I'm saying. How do I know this? Well, it's called Easter. Because when sin conquered and sin took Jesus to the graveside and he died, we typically translate that as Satan won. The reality is that Jesus was killed because of God. Because of the demands of God, not because of the power of Satan. What am I trying to tell you? That death is simply a manifestation to remind ourselves that as Christians, although we will eventually die, for us it's not the cessation of life, that it's just the beginning of newness, of eternal life. Anybody following what I'm saying? That's the beauty of that. So all the nations, look at how Jesus, in his authority and glory and power, he brings it to the nations, for the nations, and for the peoples of every language. And they, what do? They went from worshiping multitudes and plurality of deities to worship the one true God. So hear me say this clearly. I wish and I could tell you that the nations and the people from every language will come to Jesus because of the nation of Israel, because of the local church, because of our eagerness to evangelize and do missions. And again, I think we do and we want to do those things. Ultimately, how the world is and will be redeemed is exclusively by the person and the work of Jesus Christ. That's the bottom line. And he reminds us, he says, hey, I'm seeing every nation, every people group worshiping him. And then watch this, in the worshiping of Jesus, in the exaltation of this Son of Man, what I'm seeing is that the dominion of Jesus, what kind of a dominion is it? Now again, what Daniel is trying to get these people to do, and again, as a father, maybe as a single lady, whatever you are, raising young ladies, if you can help me to translate these principles into the lives of this younger generation and our generation, because typically when we look at Jesus and his dominion, we create this dichotomy, this really non-biblical tension between good and evil. I mean, you look at the movie The Avengers, and it's like, oh, at the end is good and evil, and hopefully, you know, in the previous one, evil won because, you know, some of the characters died, and then Iron Man dies. So it's like, good people are supposed to win all the time. That's not the biblical view. In the biblical view, the battle is not between evil and God or Satan and God. Why? Because there's no comparison to God. The battle is always between evil and the people of God, evil and the local church, evil and your thoughts, evil in your heart, Satan and our sinfulness. With me? Yes? No? So hear me say this. His dominion is everlasting. And then his kingdom is a kingdom that will never be destroyed. So Daniel is speaking about this other single guy. And again, because it's Father's Day, so I got to talk about singles as well, because our young ladies are going to choose single men and they're going to marry them. And that guy that they marry is going to be the father of their kids, right? So hopefully the guy that our young ladies are choosing is a guy that is able to do this faithfully to monotheism, is do this how? Respectfully to authoritarianism, and then hopefully they choose a man that is able to do this contextually in a very ungodly culture. So Jesus, what did Jesus do? Again, because Jesus was single, Daniel was single, and then the next guy that I'm going to present to you is also single. I don't believe that the win, and again, the supreme experience is marriage. I don't believe the supreme experience is singleness. I think the supreme experience is Jesus. That's it, whether you're single or married. But knowing our culture, knowing where this is going, and by the way, before I make my statement, can I just speak to you for a second? I really wish, because knowing some of you, if not most of you, you have one thing in common as a generation that came prior to mine. My generation, as a middle-aged guy, we have some of that, but we have lost it a little bit. And then my kids' generation, I don't see it. Hear me say this. Is the concept of marrying young. Marrying young. Have I said marrying young? Marrying young. What am I saying? Because if discipleship is organic and discipleship begins at home, not a church, it begins at home, think about it. Discipleship in the Bible is simply something that is brought as a succession from parents to children. So if our generation is not getting married and they're not having children, they have no one to disciple. What am I saying? Look at me for a second. What I'm saying is that as a generation, we're breathing ourselves out of existence when it comes to the values of monotheism, the values of the scriptures. All right, I knew that wasn't going to be popular. Sorry, I just had to say that. But when it comes to Jesus, he's speaking into a culture that most people are going to get married. Most people have gotten married. Most people have been married before. So marriage is simply about building a life. Do you guys agree? Definition of marriage? Is not about feeling in love all the time. I'm not against feeling in love. I just began the service by telling you that music, you know, music approaches and connects with emotions. That's what makes us human. I'm all for emotions. Just hear me say this. Marriage is simply the ability to choose. It's a choice to choose to build a life together. When I look at Daniel and then I look at Jesus, obviously the life that we build together is not our life. It's not our marriage. It's not our loved. It's not our kids. It's the life of. So marriage is about building the life of Jesus together. What does that mean? Here's what it means. Because hopefully, and again, this is another thing. People don't want to have kids. That's a different conversation for a different day. But I just told you, my dad had how many brothers and sisters? 14. That's crazy. All right, here we go. So parenting. Parenting is about building. It's about building a succession together. What's the succession? It's making disciples. So the life of Jesus, you look at Jesus, what he does from the very beginning, he begins by making, and by the way, this is not time to get into these details. Have you read the scriptures? The first guy that he chooses to be his disciple, based on what the Bible says, is a tax collector by the name of Levi, translated into the name of Brother Matthew. What am I saying? That when it comes to discipleship, we typically think of discipleship that happens when you have some sort of a. Let me see if I can get back into here. When it comes, it only happens when you have like the perfect marriage, the ideal marriage, when you have the ideal kids. Jesus is a perfect example. Jesus took as disciples. He engaged with people that did not qualify. Jesus. Engage and took and recruited people to be disciples that no church on the face of the earth would have ever called as a pastor. Secondly, none of us as parents would have want for our daughters to date those knuckleheads. And that's exactly who Jesus chose. That's the beauty of the gospel. Here's the thing. Again, making disciples, you know, in the context of family, it has to be done in a post-Christian culture because that's exactly where we are. And again, just a quick disclaimer because I only have a few minutes left. When I say post-Christian culture, just hear me say this. I don't believe that we have Christian countries. I believe that we have countries that make decisions through a Christian worldview. You see the difference? Anyways, take that home and think about it for a second. So in the case of Jesus, again, Jesus is the one that obviously the Gospels tells us what he did, what he said. But then it comes around this guy, another single guy that we believe is single, Paul. So we're in the single mode right now, okay? Paul comes and he is going to take the words of Jesus. Look at this. He takes the words of Jesus based on the words of Daniel because Daniel prophesies. Remember Daniel prophesying? I saw the vision at night. What did he see? He didn't see a better Jerusalem, a better scenario, a redemption of the people of God. He simply saw the Son of Man approaching who? The Ancient of Days. And then through that approach, through that relationship between the Father and the Son, it is where Jesus received authority, dominion, and power. And then he, obviously, we know the rest of the story, where Paul, that he met the Son of Man on the road to Damascus, remember Acts chapter 9? He meets him. So Paul did not find Jesus via Twitter. Paul did not find Jesus on a Sunday school class. Paul met the resurrected Jesus face to face. Now, Paul takes on him, and I said take on him, but it's the call of God to be an apostle to the Gentiles. He takes the task to look at the words of Jesus given through biblical narrative, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and what's the last one? And John, he takes the words of Jesus, look at this, and Paul sees the local church a couple of decades after Jesus, and he's looking at Jesus, his character, his teachings, his lifestyle. He's looking at the local church 2,000 years ago, and this is what he's seeing. He's seeing this. He's seeing the church moving further and further and further away from Jesus. And Paul says that this is a problem. This is a serious problem. So Paul is going to write about 13 of the 27 books of the New Testament to do this, to bring together the words of Jesus and the meaning of the words of Jesus. What am I saying? That the church 2,000 years ago believed on what Jesus said. as long as they had the freedom to interpret what Jesus said. Now, does that sound like 2019, beautiful United States of America? Does that sound like churches today? Does that sound like families today? That we see people having their own, people do not necessarily oppose Jesus as long as Jesus is a Republican, because God knows that he was a Republican, right? Is that how we process this? That Jesus understands my worldview, my personal preferences, what I think, how I feel? See, again, I just gave you Daniel 7, 13, and 14. Who did Daniel see? They saw, it's about Jesus. So Paul is going to take the life of Jesus, and he's going to take the succession of Jesus, making disciples, and what he's going to do, he's going to speak to churches that are, again, moving in an opposite direction. So in Ephesians 2, as an example, he begins by simply saying, therefore, verse 11. Now, obviously, the grammatical connection of a therefore implies that he has spoken for a chapter and 10 verses. What's the point? That he's coming into a closing of his sermon, which he's a preacher. That's a lie. There's three more chapters to go. So you know how preachers are. He's telling, oh, therefore, conclusion. No, it's not. He's going to continue. So he's coming into a closing of this, and he's bringing what we believe a third principle. The previous two principles that he introduced from chapters 1 to chapter 2 up to verse 10 is simply the understanding that God has this authority, dominion, he's sovereign, and is the doctrine of election. The doctrine of election. God chooses, God makes decisions. The way he chose Abraham, the way he chose a family, the way he chose a nation, and the way he chose the world. Now, hear me say this closely, folks, because this is where it gets really, really crazy. I just gave you the example of Jesus choosing Levi, eventually becomes Matthew, tax collector. Not only that Jesus chose Levi, like if I'm doing a side job, part-time deal, running Jesus's, you know, social media, marketing team in his time, and he's running for Messiah, you know, in this time in history, and his first choice is Matthew, I'm like, I don't know if I want to take a selfie with Matthew, man. I mean, this guy doesn't have a very good reputation among the people you're trying to redeem. Secondly, you know what Jesus did? Jesus not only chooses Matthew, but he goes and has dinner at Matthew's home, watch this, not with former tax collectors, but with current active tax collectors. I'm like, I'm deleting all of the social media. No one saw this. I don't want anyone to see what's going on with Jesus, because Jesus is not going, he's not helping himself. Have you ever found yourself in a situation where you're like, this is not working out for me? The more that I pray, the more that I try, the more that I read the scriptures, it's not working out for me. Paul finds himself in that scenario because God chooses, elects people. And when I think about election, think about this. God elected a pagan Gentile priest by the name of Abraham. So that's the first thing that he introduced. The second thing that he introduced is that God chooses not because of Abraham, not because of these people, but in spite. So he introduces in Ephesians the concept of depravity, the concept of how broken we are. And then he presents the solution, which is the therefore. The solution is that when he chose us, when he elected his people, the nation of Israel, the church of Jesus Christ, he elected us to bring a concept of universality of the gospel. That it was in because of you that he made the decision, but it was in spite of us. Does that make sense? So here's my point. My point is this. Again, discipling our kids and our grandkids. Help the next generation to understand that knowing and loving Jesus is always personal, is never individual. I'm going to say that again. Is always personal, because you cannot have or embrace the faith of your parents. You have to make your own choices. You have to have the ability given by God to trust in Jesus. But once you trust in Jesus, and this is why water baptism is extremely important, because water baptism is an outward manifestation of an internal experience at a personal level, that when the individual is brought into the water, we practice by immersion, is brought into the water, at a personal level, you're joining Jesus in his sufferings. You're dying to self the way that Jesus died to self. Now, Jesus died physically. We don't have to die physically yet, but we're dying in a sense of, you know, internal, emotional, intellectual, spiritually, we're dying, no more. But then when you come out of the water, you don't come out of the water simply as a brand new person, although you are. You don't come out of the water simply as a redeemed, regenerated person, although you are. You come out of the water to join a family. A family. And it's the family of God, which is tangibly manifested in our scenario, contextualized through the global church, but also through the local church. So this is why individualism is one of the signs of people who have never understood the gospel. My argument is and will continue to be, and it was for the church of Ephesus, that as long as we practice this me-ism, Jesus will continue to be perceived as a cosmic butler. And Jesus is no errand boy. We just read from Daniel hundreds of years previous that he has all authority, all dominion, sovereign power. And I don't believe that you can experience the dominion, the supremacy, the beauty and the majesty of God at an individual level. You can only experience the fullness of God in community. You get to be free not only from the wrath of God, you get to be free not only from, in this case, from hell, but you get to be free from self. So in this case, look at Paul saying, he's basically saying, I want you to remember that formerly you who are Gentiles, which now you have come and joined the family of God by birth, and you were called uncircumcised by those who call themselves the circumcision, which is done in the body by human hands. So Paul is reminding them that from the very beginning, from Abraham all the way down to those who were from the lineage of Abraham, all the way that now is outside of the lineage of Abraham, which are Gentiles, look what happens. The principle never changed. The circumcision, look at me, circumcision, that for us today, it's not a physical manifestation. It's a spiritual manifestation. Yes? No? Look at me for a second. Circumcision is today spiritual. We're circumcised. And the circumcision is that through the cutting, which in this case, that cutting, that detachment was Jesus. Jesus at the cross cried out and said, Father, why have you detached from me? Why have you isolated me? Because it was necessary for Jesus to be set apart from God, so we can be set apart for God. Can I say that again? I'm going to say that one more time. It was necessary for Jesus to be set apart from God. So the one who knew no sin for our sake became sin, right? But this experience of Friday, Saturday, and eventually Sunday only has meaning through 33 years of life on earth, because you and I being set apart for him is not simply the absence of previous mistakes. It's not simply joining a body of believers. It's not simply changing your behavior and thinking like a Christian, reading the Bible and praying. All those things are extremely important. What it means to be set apart for him is embracing the worldview, the lifestyle of 33 years of the one that was set apart from him. That's what it means. So Paul is basically saying, since now you are not Gentiles anymore, now you're part of the lineage, you're part of the family of God. Hear me say this, look at me. It creates a privilege. It creates a privilege that now you were a Gentile, you were an outcast, you were outside of the family of God. When you came into the family of God, it gives you the privilege that in the past, when you were set apart from him, now you are set apart for him. But hear me say this, because this is where it gets a little crazy. What Paul is saying, that if you continue, if you disregard not only the teachings of Jesus, but the meaning of the teachings of Jesus, the same God that set you apart for him will set you apart from him. Book of Daniel. The tragedy of Daniel, besides the tragedy of the Babylonians, besides of the conquest and exile, here's the tragedy. Look at me for a second. Is that this people who were set apart for him were surprised that God eventually came through on what he promised. That if you violate, if you disregard my commands, I will set you apart not only from me, watch this, but I'm going to use evil. I'm going to use brokenness to ridicule you, to show you that you do not play with me, that I'm a God of righteousness, that you being set apart for me is not because you are VIP. It's not because of what you have done, but it's in spite of what you have done. So here's how he brings it. Remember that at that time when you were set apart for him, in the past you were separated from Christ, you were excluded from citizenship in Israel, and you were foreigners to the covenants of the promise without hope and without God in the world. This is who you were. What's the point? Look at me. That when it comes to your kids and my kids, when it comes to the younger generation, and especially, because remember, at the beginning, I spoke of hymns, and I spoke about hymns being sang, and it reminds you of people that you met, that shape you and influence you. Look at me for a second. The people that are in the most dangerous condition today, this is my argument, you can disagree with me, that's fine, not a problem, but I believe the people who are in the most dangerous place when it comes to the relationship with God, is literally our kids who grew up in church. Because our kids will look at verse like this and say, I don't have any tattoos. I didn't have sex before marriage. I go to church. I tithe. So I should be a Christian. No, you're not. No, you're not. See, Jesus never simply improves the behavior of people. Jesus exposes the brokenness, that this is who you and I were before Jesus. We were separated, we were excluded, we were foreigners, we were without hope, and we were without God. That's exactly who we are. That's where the conversation begins, regardless of who your parents and grandparents were. Doesn't matter who they were. So this is why what Paul is describing, that the issue for these people is that they had different foundation from God. This is the people of God. There were different foundation. But with Jesus, now they have the cornerstone, which is Jesus. And their rebellion was intentional. So how does he fix that? He fixes it by simply saying, now you're a part of the covenants of the promise. Give me 2 minutes to explain the covenants of God. Here are the covenants of God. In the Old Testament, it was about obedience and performance. Made by whom? And when we violated in the Old Testament, this, what was supposed to be a blessing, became a curse. So we were cursed by the law. In the New Testament, exactly the same principle. In the New Testament, it's by obedience and performance. The beauty of the gospel is that it's not your obedience and it's not your performance. Whose performance is it? The beauty of the character of Jesus. So this morning, I simply wanted you to pray with me that the covenants of God, which is the solution, which is the answer to everything that we're saying, is simply the understanding that God elected the people of God for two things. In the Old Testament for service and the New Testament for Christ's likeness. That implies that this morning, if you are sitting in this place and you are willing to embrace the worldview, you are willing to embrace the election for service and Christ's likeness, and you decide to become a Christian, here's what it means. That means that you must respond. You have to say yes to Jesus. You have to say yes to Jesus. Look at me. You have to say yes to Jesus. Saying yes to Jesus is not simply because you have regrets. It's because you try all these options and now let's give it a shot to Jesus because Jesus is one among many. The human response is this, is based and created out of the human response is simply the result of God's election. The men are able to respond to God when God chooses that individual. What is my point? That when you are chosen by God and you respond to that, you must have faith that translates into faithfulness. You must repent. That must become habitual, not just an event. You must obey, which obedience is simply Christ's likeness. And you must persevere to the end, which is the result of the God who chooses to preserve you. Folks, Father's Day is simply about the life of Jesus and the succession of Jesus. Father's Day is the beauty to see that represented in this younger generation. This is one of the most exciting times in human history to know Jesus Christ. Why? Here's why. Here's why. Here's why. Listen closely. Because in no other time in human history, in the history of the United States, we have had that many number of people that can potentially embrace Jesus Christ. And it's been entrusted to you, and it's been entrusted to me. That today, we have the privilege to embrace Vacation Bible School, the 1st of July, 2nd of July, 3rd of July, and we're going to receive families and kids. And it requires men and women that are willing to simply understand that this is about the life of Jesus. It is about the worldview of Jesus.